I'm Brooke Gladstone with this week's podcast extra. The story you're about to hear takes place at the dangerous intersection between journalism and art, a place easier to reach when the journey is fueled by obsession. In this case, two: the journalist's obsession with his choice to take a particular photo, and a playwright's obsession with that journalist. The combined result? A memoir, an opera, a book of poems, and a play. Also, a rather strange, enduring friendship. It's hard to pinpoint the roots of those obsessions, but we do know when they took wing. For the journalist, Paul Watson of the Toronto Star, it was 1993 in Mogadishu, Somalia, the day he found a mob dragging the body of an American soldier through the streets and took three pictures, one of which earned him a Pulitzer Prize. For the playwright, Dan O'Brien, it was 2007 when he heard Paul Watson recount that day on public radio. Let's start with Paul. Would you tell us about that photo?
Yes, it's the image of Staff Sergeant William David Cleveland. After a roughly 16-hour battle, more than one Black Hawk helicopter had been shot down. He was the crew chief on one of them, which is the serviceman who sits at the door with a large-caliber machine gun. You know, I was informed that Americans had been taken, and it became obvious that there was a dead American being paraded, pulled by ropes through the streets.
Describe the picture.
It is of a nearly naked man. He has green army underwear on, that's all. He has many bullet holes. As they tug the ropes one way or another, his body was limp. It moved like a marionette because rigor mortis hadn't set in. You know, I wonder to this day, was he alive at that moment?
It wasn't the worst picture you've taken in a lifetime of war reporting.
Exactly. And I had photographed dead and injured people many times before that day and many times after. The Rwandan genocide, which came soon after this, there was a Catholic church where hundreds of villagers had taken refuge, and the killers behind the genocide entered the church and literally executed them one by one. And I will never forget a child whose face had been cleaved open with a machete knife. But I didn't hear voices that day. I did what I always did, which was to robotically record things that I saw in writing and to make photographs.
But you did hear voices on the day you shot that picture of Staff Sergeant Cleveland. The sentence, "If you take this picture, I will own you forever," followed you. And some 13 years later, you wrote your memoir, Where War Lives. And that's where the second obsessionist comes in, poet and playwright Dan O'Brien. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Now, I assume you saw that photo of that soldier at some point in your life. What drew you to Paul Watson 13 years later?
Paul Watson was on Fresh Air with Terry Gross in 2007, talking about taking that photograph and hearing that voice.
How did you interpret it when you heard his voice saying, "If you do this, I will own you forever"?
I took it as a warning. The response that I thought was, just understand that I have to do this. I don't have a choice. I don't want to participate in your desecration, because that's what I did. And yet, I had to photograph what they were doing in order to tell the truth, because the truth was being denied by the Pentagon.
And it was specifically that part of the story that I felt haunting me.
Why?
You know, if I knew that right away, I wouldn't have written about him for so long. You know, the play and two collections of poetry and an opera, it's been a process of finding out for myself why it was that I was so compelled, intrigued, disturbed, frightened by Paul's story. So I emailed him out of the blue, and for some strange reason, he wrote back.
I've literally hundreds of unopened emails in my inbox, which I've built up over years. And even when I did reply to him, I was hoping he would go away.
Why did you respond to him at all?
I don't know. Just when you ask the question, I shiver. It does me no good to sound crazy, and I know this sounds crazy to people, but I think I'm part of something I don't understand. And I just did what I was supposed to do.
Had you ever heard a ghost prior to that moment?
Never. I've only heard that one voice, and I haven't heard it since.
We have a clip from the play, The Body of an American, which is now running in New York at the Cherry Lane Theater. It's a scene portraying you, Paul, attempting to seek professional help from a South African psychologist where you were living.
You okay with this, Paul? Because Paul's never actually seen the play.
Why the hell haven't you seen the play? Are you afraid of it?
I'm afraid of it.
Why?
Just talking to you about this is very difficult for me. I really want it to go away. There's certain things that'll just open that door a bit, and there's something that'll throw it wide open. I don't go home and think about this. I don't talk to my wife about it. It just goes away. But I want to talk about it because my whole goal, the reason I wrote the book with the title Where War Lives, the answer to the question Where War Lives is it lives in us, each one of us. I keep meeting people now who have seen the play who want to talk about the war inside his or her heart. That's why I'm willing to go through the rest. Otherwise, I wish it would just go away.
I'm going to play you this clip now.
Now, I'll ask you some questions to rule out schizophrenia.
I told him about the picture.
It's famous. That's yours.
Then I told him what Cleveland's voice told me.
That was your superego. Your mind was simply speaking to itself.
I know what my own mind sounds like. This was somebody else.
The soldier.
I felt him next to me. Feared his presence.
Is he here with us now?
He is. He's here when I wake up. He's there when I'm asleep. He's with me whenever I'm happy, when I'm having fun or sex or watching TV, as if he's saying, this cannot last. And of course he's with me whenever things go wrong. He's happiest when I'm in pain. He'll never go away till he gets what he wants from me.
And what does he want from you, Paul?
And what does he want from you, Paul?
The original encounter was a threatening one. It was, don't do this. It wasn't, well, if you do this, we're going to have a long relationship and we can change the world. That wasn't what it was about. It was, don't do it. People have tried to persuade me to find good in this, and that's not where it started.
Dan, Paul responded to you, I think, because these professionals weren't bringing enough to the table, and you seemed to function as a confessor, an interpreter, sometimes a stenographer, an amplifier. What did you want from Paul?
I wanted connection. I wanted to explore my own story without necessarily telling my story by telling his. Every ghost story, the question is, what does the ghost want? And does the ghost get what he or she wants? So the question for me was also, you know, what's going to happen with Paul's story? What's going to happen with my ghosts, my past traumas, my war within?
Did his ghost resemble yours?
Yes. I mean, I'm somewhat embarrassed to say that in front of Paul because, of course, his experiences are so vastly different and much more extreme. But, you know, pain is relative. And, that sense of being pursued, being cursed is one I still struggle with 8 years later. I think in some ways I struggle with it a little less because I've written about Paul. And again, what it's done for people that have read the poetry or seen the play and seem to find meaning in this horror that Paul has witnessed.
Now, your story has to do very much with pretty messed up family and a brother who seems to me serves as a daily reproach.
When I was 12 years old and my brother was 17, I witnessed a suicide attempt.
He threw himself out the window.
Right, of the attic of our house. Made me an artist, I think, at the age of 12, in an attempt to understand what was happening to my family and to me.
But you didn't confront it.
Yeah, and that's a big realization for the character in the play, to realize that as a child, I was just so obviously terrified and didn't understand what was happening. You know, my parents, they struggled with mental illness of their own. They just pretended it didn't happen. So being able to connect with Paul was a way to try to come to terms with that experience with my brother.
You wrote a libretto for an opera on Paul's story, and I watched some of it on YouTube. And of course, it's a terrible disadvantage. Opera starts at such a high pitch of emotion. Anywhere you drop into it, it can seem a little ridiculous. It can seem even a little more ridiculous when Paul and you are both so soft-spoken. It seems like perhaps it's the wrong form for it.
It's experimental. Paul did see the opera. So this is the one manifestation of our collaboration that Paul did witness. And I think—
I was present at the opera.
He was present.
The opera starts with the sound of helicopter rotor blades. It really sounds like a helicopter is hovering above your head. I immediately had a panic attack. The experience of hearing a helicopter rotor in a theater in Stanford University, an opera surrounded it, almost killed me. I couldn't breathe, literally. But if you put me in Afghanistan tomorrow with helicopters and the heat and the fumes and the anger, I'm at home. I'm okay there. I'm not okay dealing with it outside of the reality of it.
The opera, that heaviness that I found so odd, is still understandable, I think, to a degree, because the weight Paul seems to carry from having taken this picture is so immense. Paul, you took this photo because a similar incident in Mogadishu had happened, and there was no photo, and so you felt compelled to take this photo in an effort to tell the world this was going on.
That's exactly right. A Black Hawk had been shot down. American body parts had been taken out of the wreckage and paraded. And I reported that, and it went out around the world, and the Pentagon denied it. I remember the words almost exactly. There was no basis, in fact, to reports that American body parts are being paraded through the streets of Mogadishu. No pictures, didn't happen. That's why I was so determined to get a photograph on October 4th. I collapsed in a mess when I got back to my hotel room. I took the film out of the camera, stuffed it under the mattress, because I figured I'd been spotted from the air by American forces and that they would come and want the film. So I hid it, locked the door, and had a breakdown. But I knew that I had to do it, because otherwise how are people going to know the truth of what's happening there?
And yet you seem to hold yourself at least partially responsible for the Rwandan genocide because you took that picture.
Right. Doesn't that sound arrogant? Memos were sent out from the White House that no American official was permitted to use the word genocide when referring to the mass killing in Rwanda. Why? Because that would trigger international law and that would require an intervention. And I think President Clinton later admitted that they didn't want to intervene in Rwanda because the political consequences of the debacle in Somalia made it impossible to risk another debacle. Well, I can tell you, having covered both, Rwanda was completely different. You would only have needed to fly a few helicopters around, and those idiots would have run for the trees, and we would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives.
And then, an even heavier weight, the fact that Al-Qaeda, which was in Mogadishu at the time, that's well understood, took a lesson from how the Americans behaved. I felt like you actually in the play, Dan, went through this Al-Qaeda connection really quickly.
Yeah, but I think that's pretty much a quote from Terry Gross.
What you're saying is it was used in a way as a tool by Al-Qaeda to exaggerate the power of the opposition to America.
That's right. You know, take all the events that happened and then remove the photograph, and Al-Qaeda would not have chased American forces out of Somalia. Bin Laden would not have been able to tell his followers, we're able to do this. We only need small victories to defeat history's greatest military. Enter the picture, and they are able to do that.
In writing about him, it seems that so much of Paul's experience you've absorbed and then owned as if you'd had them yourself. And let me ask you, Paul, does that bother you at all?
I really have no interest in what he used, what he didn't. I don't even remember most of what I gave him. I didn't know if he was a good playwright or a bad playwright, and I didn't care whether anyone made a play. It was just a sense that I'm supposed to do this. So I did it.
You know, I felt from the beginning that Paul's work needed an interpreter to my world, if that makes sense, so that people that see plays, people that read poems and write poems, could feel it more deeply, could understand it more deeply. So, you know, on a basic level, I have simply felt like an interpreter or a translator, bringing it into another form and perhaps for a different audience.
He succeeded where I failed.
How did you fail?
The book went nowhere, pretty much, and, you know, no one ever wrote me and said, you changed my life. I had a woman come up to me the other day who saw the play when it was a different production in Philadelphia and said, you know, my mother's a Holocaust survivor, and I've never been able to talk to her about it, and it just eats away at me. She was at the stage the other night, and she grabbed my hand and said, do you remember me? And I didn't really straight away. But then she said, you know, I've started speaking to my mother about the Holocaust. And I broke down, and I thought, that's why I'm supposed to do this. When I was younger, the big question, you know, what do we really want? I used to say happiness. And then it took me some time to come around to understanding that what we all really want is love, in the sense of a universal love that gives you strength. When you're dying, you're not afraid because you know your presence is acknowledged and you're loved, and that gives you the comfort to go. I sort of reached a stage more recently where I think what we all want is peace, and that's certainly what I want now, is I just need peace.
But do you think you should have taken that picture? You did it to bring a story to the world that was denied by the military about what was going on in Mogadishu. You tie it directly to American inaction in Rwanda. You talk about how Al-Qaeda in Mogadishu bragged about how it was able to bring America to its knees. All that consequence, potentially, from a single photo, does that give us peace? You say you'd be happy to be dumped back down in Kabul today. Would that give you peace?
The short of it is I wish I hadn't taken the picture, but I know that I had to. And so that conflict is unresolvable in my mind. I don't like what it has done to me. I don't like what it's doing to me now. But I had no choice. This sounds flippant, but I believe it. I think peace comes with death. I just hope that in the final minutes, if I'm lucky enough to think as I'm dying, I hope it comes then, because I don't want to be afraid. It's very hard to be afraid, and it's coming at us all the time. Be afraid, be afraid. We don't need that.
Are you still taking scary pictures?
No. But mostly that wasn't my choice. My former employer couldn't afford the insurance, which, as you know, is happening in the news media. We're retreating.
Do you wish you could still be taking scary pictures?
Very deeply. I know, but the strange thing is I'm not afraid there.
But what about the rest of us?
Right. But, you know, you can justify it as journalists do, and they use this wonderful heroic term, witness. It's great. But I think it's nonsense. But if I were in that place doing, you know, what you just suggested, I would be doing it for a selfish reason. I'd be doing it because that's where I belong. I wouldn't be doing it to change the world anymore because I don't think anybody's paying attention. I would be doing it because I feel comfortable there and that's where I want to leave the world.
You know, my wife read the first draft years ago and said, oh, my God, you've written a happy ending. And in my mind, this is a very happy ending. It's happy the way I can be happy, which is full of a certain amount of ambivalence and contradiction. I think it's a very – I hope it's an honest and realistic ending. But the story is a story of what's happening right here, is people sharing and talking and connecting. And even though it's a cliche, witnessing each other's trauma, because A, it helps you deal with what's happened in the past, and because it – you know, that's the purpose of art, as far as I can tell, is to connect and to help people live. You may not have peace or happiness necessarily. I mean, what do I search for, you know, or hope for? It's meaning. You know, I want to have meaning in my life. And that doesn't mean that something is easy or that I feel happy or even that I feel peaceful. But I want to feel that my work means something, not just to me but to other people.
Are you still writing about Paul?
Yes. We're writing a new play. I say we, although he won't read it and he won't see it. But I am adapting some of his reporting and his experiences in Syria for a new play, as well as a version for a TV drama about Western reporters covering Syria.
You're a pretty young man. Do you foresee a time when you won't be telling Paul's stories?
Are you suggesting he get a life?
I do. I do and I don't. I mean, I am writing other plays that are not about Paul Watson. I haven't finished them, but I am writing other plays. I am writing a rock opera about Sasquatch, which sounds like the natural
follow-on.
Yeah. No, but I would say that this new play about Paul is in some ways about Paul moving on from war reporting and going to be about that, as well as me, you know, moving on from writing about Paul. And just, can you leave war behind? Should you leave war behind? Those are the sorts of questions I want to look at in the play.
Thank you very much.
No, that was a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Dan O'Brien is the author of Body of an American, running through March 20th at New York's Cherry Lane Theater. And Paul Watson is the author of Where War Lives, and currently a book about ghosts in the Arctic. You've been listening to an OTM Podcast Extra. If you want to keep up with all things on the media, how about subscribing to our newsletter, which you can do at our website? And if you have a couple of minutes to spare, go to iTunes and leave us a review. It helps other people find the podcast, and it makes us feel good. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.